Local news breaking this afternoon as Boston Mayor Marty Walsh announces the Boston Public Schools will start entirely online this year and then phase in a hybrid learning model after. Here's Mayor Walsh at a press conference just a few hours ago.
We feel this is the best approach to educate our children. It creates a staggered approach for students to return to the classroom in a safe and careful way.
So here to tell us what this means for parents, students, teachers, is WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Max, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So Max, we're hearing Boston Public Schools starts entirely online, may not stay that way. It doesn't sound like it plans to stay that way. What is the plan?
Yeah, Tiziana, there's this effort here to kind of find the best of all possible worlds when all possible worlds are all a little dicey. So teachers will show up back in school September 8th, and then the year will kick off on September 21st with remote learning for every student. Now, then on October 1st, or I should say no earlier than October 1st, the students with the highest needs will be allowed to come back. And then they'll sort of gradually roll out, basically so that younger students can get back in buildings over the course of October. Now, these are not fixed dates, as we'll discuss. And Mayor Walsh also emphasized there's an element of choice here for families where people can opt out of in-person learning. If we could have a listen.
We are being responsive to all of the concerns that our families and our children have. We are making the in-school component of hybrid learning an optional step for all families.
And this theme of optional, flexible, call an audible seems to kind of flow through all of it. The in-person dates, as you said, Max, are not set in stone. So where is that flexibility? What are the roadblocks? What's the latest students might be in? Do we even know?
I don't think we do know, Tiziana, and I'm sure that's causing an extra layer of anxiety for families, mm-hmm. teachers, and students today. I think so much is going to depend on the daily churn of pandemic data. So in today's press conference, for example, Mayor Walsh pointed out that if the COVID positive test rate for the city at large rises to 4% or above, then in-person school just can't go forward. But Tiziana, of course, they're still working out the kinks in that equation. You know, what happens if it hits 4% in East Boston, where last week it was 7%, or in Mattapan, where it was 4.2%. And then you have the state in the background. Yesterday, Governor Charlie Baker repeated his plea, one he's made many times, saying the science favors in-person learning as much as possible. But so far, he's left that decision to local officials.
So how are parents and teachers feeling this afternoon? Have you heard, you know, outstanding concerns, questions, reactions?
Yeah, this is pretty fresh news. And the last citywide snapshot we have of opinion dates from July. If you weight that survey to match the racial and ethnic makeup of the city, about a third of families wanted this kind of fully online start, and they're going to get it starting on September 21st. And then about 38% more wanted a blended or hybrid model, which is what they'll get depending on the COVID data and the ages and needs of their child or children at some point in October. So a bunch of parents seem to be pleased that there isn't going to be this mad rush physically into schools. But then you also see people in the minority on social media asking, what are working parents supposed to do in yet more weeks of remote learning with kids at home? And then finally, you have some teachers saying, well, this might be safe for kids, but a lot more of us are expected to be back in building starting on September 8th. So there's some worry there.
So Max, what's the next step for Boston Public Schools students, parents? What do they do now?
Well, I think you got to prepare. You want to make sure that you have adequate technological resources at home for more weeks than in remote learning. That was a big problem in the spring. Notionally, everyone's got a Chromebook from the district who needs one, but there'll be other programs to make sure that the tech is adequate. Then you might want to have a conversation as a family about whether you want to be one of those families that opts out, decides not to do this. And then otherwise, it's you know, sort of back to school as slightly normal, I think.
Well, we're going to continue to watch this with you, Max. And as you said, this is fresh news. So I really appreciate you hopping onto Radio Boston to update our listeners. That's WBUR education reporter Max Larkin.
Thank you.
Let's turn to our Week in Review panelists. With us remotely is Jane Swift, former Republican Massachusetts governor, now the president and executive director of Learn Launch. Governor Swift, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, a member of the National NAACP Board, and deputy CEO and general counsel for the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Michael, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Listeners, pull up a chair, join the conversation. The state's largest school district is starting the year all remote. Just found it out. Call us with your reactions. What do you make of the decision? What about what your city and town is doing, city or town? How are you feeling about that? 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So, Jane, Michael, so much for the myth of a sleepy August. Things seem to be changing every day. Jane, what's your reaction to the news this afternoon?
Well, I can't say that I'm surprised, as I think we've talked about on this show before. Learn Launch, which I run, has a contract with the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. And we have been working all summer long with school and district leaders to try to help them build their capacity for these new modes of learning. And this is an incredibly complex time. And I would just disagree a little bit. There is going to be nothing normal about this school year. It's not going to be normal at its start for parents, for students, for school leaders, for teachers. And the more that folks begin to think about ways to make it a positive experience where possible, ways that it can work for them, as hard as that is, I think the better. That's not at all to diminish the extraordinary challenges that these schedules present. But I do think it is important to point out in Boston, as Mayor Walsh said, as well as in many districts across the Commonwealth, I've gotten, besides the work we're doing officially at Learn Launch, lots of friends who have been calling me who are getting these letters from their district with this choice, really, that most families have never had before, asking them to select a mode of learning. And that in and of itself is causing a great deal of confusion, although ultimately a lot of empowerment for parents who, unlike in the spring, at least are able to evaluate what might work best for their families and their children.
And Michael, are there winners and losers with this announcement? You know, I almost hate to frame it that way, but I have to believe there will be those who are thrilled about this and those who are crushed. That seems to be the only type of option that we're facing with schools reopening.
Yeah, you know, Tiziana, I would describe it as conflicting and competing priorities. I think this is what a pandemic has taught us, that, you know, whether it's, you know, curtailing the spread and protecting the economy, that conflict that existed, or preserving PPE and getting a good sound medical judgment around what protects you from virus. And now we're at this point around schools, and we're looking at, you know, how do we keep our kids on track for quality education and dealing with the social, emotional supports that they need. And the conflict comes when we're also talking about keeping students, parents, teachers safe. And we're seeing credit to the mayor for making that decision. I'm hoping that decision was based on student parent engagement and them making a choice along with the city. But I'll tell you, it's probably also pressure, because if you look across the country, Chicago, New York, teachers unions are really mobilizing because they realize that this disease is taking lives. It's taking the lives of many teachers that are most in that demographic of being at risk. And we're at a really difficult place. So to Tiziana, I think if there's any message, it's also a sort of a case study after this pandemic is over, all the competing priorities that are playing out in society.
So, Jane, yesterday we were talking with former Governor Deval Patrick about a whole bunch of things. And one of the things that came up was whether the state has struck the right balance between guidance and freedom of choice for districts. And we heard Max at the top here talking about that the governor wants people in person, but has left it up to the districts. You know, Governor Patrick had said that it's a hard balance. And he also talked about the importance that teachers play for families. Here he is.
You know, homeschooling is no joke. It is hard. And, you know, if there are silver linings to some of this, I hope more folks are respecting and honoring what teachers do day in and day out. It's magical. And it's enabling, of course, especially for working parents.
So he hits both things there, the incredible role that teachers play and the fact that working parents need that. I want to ask another former governor, what is the right balance in providing guidance or mandates versus leaving it up to local districts? The governor doesn't seem to be thrilled with the choices a lot of districts are making right now. We have at least 30% of Massachusetts districts are choosing to start online. And we've heard superintendents say, boy, it sure would have helped to have some more specific mandates as we tried to thread this needle.
Well, when there are a whole range of imperfect choices and not a lot of time with which to create a new structure, I think that's where you end up. I will say that I think the public health, I listened to the CEO of Children's Hospital, Sandy Fenwick, on a podcast yesterday, talking about the different reasons why there is a lot that would say where there's low levels of disease, why it would make sense to send children to school. I will tell you that moving between a hybrid model and a fully remote model, knowing a lot about ed tech and continuity of pedagogy is a very, very difficult thing to do. And for the last almost 20 years, having worked in and been a proponent for these innovative, flexible models, none of them were built to be able to scale up to handle every student in the entire country coming into those models all at once. I think the most important thing for all of us to focus on as we're in the middle of this pandemic, and I think Michael was talking about that, this is a huge burden for many students. Local control will change what the complexity and the model looks like town to town, but one thing won't change. There are a segment of students for whom the equity issues will be profound and learning loss will be a scale that we will not have seen before as a Commonwealth and as a country. And so doing everything we can to mitigate that learning loss and to make whatever choices districts and states make less inequitable, I think, is the obligation that we all have. And then figuring out as we come out at some point of this crisis situation, how we mitigate those inequities is going to really be the work of the next probably 5 years.
So we're going to continue to talk about this. We have been for weeks. We'll continue to do so here on Radio Boston. And listeners, as a note, Mayor Marty Walsh will join us on Monday for our monthly segment with him. And of course, we'll be talking about it with him then too. Before we go to a break, Michael, Jane, I want to switch gears. There's another piece of news that broke in the last 24 hours. The Justice Department has said that it will, in fact, attempt to reinstate the death penalty for Boston Marathon bomber Joe Harsanyi after an appeals court overruled the previous death sentence. So U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling intends to appeal to the Supreme Court first and is prepared to mount a second trial. Judge Nancy Gertner, who was WBUR's legal analyst, a retired federal judge, talked about the Supreme Court angle this morning on Morning Edition. Here she is.
I am very skeptical that the Supreme Court would take this case. This is not a case that raised any unusual legal issues or was involved issues as to which courts were divided. This is a straightforward application of law to facts.
So then it probably comes down to another trial. Michael, reactions?
Yeah, I think I agree. I can't imagine the Supreme Court taking this case either. I think, you know, it is a emotionally charged decision. And I'd be interesting what the polling is saying, what people think about whether the death penalty should be in this case. We know here in Massachusetts, we've been collectively opposed to the death penalty, but this is sort of touching close to the nerve as we lost lives here in the city, and it terrorized the community. I have my own concerns around death penalty that that are clear as a civil rights activist. But I am concerned if this becomes just the opening door to more death penalty cases.
Jane, I remember way back when reflecting as a guest on Radio Boston the day that Tsarnaev was found guilty, that the arcs of justice and the legal process are different than the arc of healing. And I wonder, how does reopening this sentencing case affect our collective ability to heal here in the Commonwealth and the ability to heal of the families who are most directly affected by the bombing?
Yeah, I'm glad that that is the question you posed to me, because that was where my reaction went. Is my heart just aches for the families, anyone who's ever lost a child, anybody who's suffered the loss of a family member knows that it's not as if those wounds ever close. You know, the pain just changes and in its shape, but I feel just such compassion and empathy for the families who will be put through another public trial. And I just am hopeful that the U.S. Attorney's Office has been in contact with those victims, because oftentimes the wheels of justice forget to include the thoughts and emotions of victims. And certainly in this case, in particular, where the lives that were lost were the lives of young people, and parents in particular have had to live with that reality. I would hope their thoughts have been taken into consideration with all the decisions that are being made.
And Michael, just briefly before we go to break, if Joe Biden takes over in November, because obviously there's no chance this is going to like go to trial in 76 days or after November, I guess. Yeah, let me backtrack, because he won't actually, if he wins, take it over until January. But
right.
Would the Biden administration likely change course?
I think that's unclear. You know, I don't know, and would have to search back as to Biden's position on this particular issue. You know, what's sort of seared in my mind is Biden's coming here after those bombings and his speech at the church, where he was very emotional, probably one of the best speeches I've seen him give other than the speech at the convention. So I think this would be emotional for him as well, having lost a son under different circumstances. But again, to the governor's point about the connection of losing a child, I think it's unclear.
And we're going to turn our attention now to the first virtual political convention in history. It was rich with characters and sound. Let's hear some of it.
We the people call the 48th Quadrennial Democratic National Convention to order.
George should be alive today. Breonna Taylor should be alive today. Ahmaud Arbery should be alive today. Eric Garner should be alive today. Stephon Clark, or Tatiana Jefferson, Sandra Bland, they should all be alive today.
My dad was a healthy 65-year-old. His only pre-existing condition was trusting Donald Trump. And for that, he paid with his life.
Donald Trump is the wrong president for our country.
Donald Trump hasn't grown into the job because he can't.
COVID-19 was Trump's biggest test. He failed miserably.
The calamari comeback state of Rhode Island casts one vote for Bernie Sanders and 34 votes for the next president, Joe Biden.
That I am here tonight is a testament to the dedication of generations before me. Women and men who believed so fiercely in the promise of equality, liberty, and justice for all.
About a few months ago, I met him in New Hampshire. It was really amazing to hear that someone like me became vice President.
If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us, not the worst. I'll be an ally of the light, not the darkness. It's time for us, for we the people, to come together.
And we heard there from Philanese Floyd, Kristen Urquiza, First Lady Michelle Obama, President Barack Obama, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Representative Joseph McNamara, Senator Kamala Harris, Braden Harrington, and Vice President Joe Biden. Listeners, did you watch? Were you convinced? And what did you think of this new format or medium? Is it the way we should do national conventions in the years to come? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Michael, let's start with the top line. What are your takeaways from the Democratic National Convention this week?
Yeah, I think we've all been sort of forced in this moment of a pandemic to do things differently. This convention really will tee off not only the Republican convention, but other conventions across the country that will be virtual. I thought, you know, quite frankly, I found much more substance in my many years of one, going to conventions, and two, watching conventions. I thought there was so much more substance, a lot less of the pomp and circumstance, to have so much diversity as they traveled the country for the nominations with a lot of racial, ethnic, cultural diversity within those votes. I thought it was pretty rich to have the young man sharing his connection to Joe Biden. I think for me, there are some highlights. The Floyd family still speaking to the injustice of his murder and those other murders across the country. It was compelling to me, First Lady Obama's remarks. I thought she was surgical in her case that she made against our current president. I hope that Republican voters, independent voters, were listening and not caught up and sort of stuck on their commitment to this president, but about his failure to be the president that we expected him to be, or we hoped, well, we should have hoped that he would be. And then last but not least, I thought both President Obama gave the most masterful speech that I've ever heard him give, combined with Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, who are very effective as well.
So, Jane, Michael just talked about some of the most powerful speeches there. He also said that he hopes that the messages were going to reach Republicans and independent voters. There were actually, interestingly, a parade of prominent Republicans, John Kasich, Colin Powell. Let's listen for just a second here to Republican and former Ohio Governor John Kasich, who ran for president, by the way, literally standing at a crossroads endorsing Biden over Trump. Here he is.
I'm sure there are Republicans and independents who couldn't imagine crossing over to support a Democrat. They fear Joe may turn sharp left and leave them behind. I don't believe that, because I know the measure of the man. It's reasonable, faithful, respectful. And you know, no one pushes Joe around.
Is it going to work, Jane?
So, you know, like in any election, there's a very narrow group of people who have not decided, particularly in this election with this president. And the goal has to be to reach that group of voters. And I think to a certain degree, what you're trying to do is to convince them to either come to vote or to pull a lever for Joe Biden as opposed to a third party candidate or, just not voting at all. And so I think from that standpoint, it was appropriate to bring in those other voices. It seems clear that they are less worried about getting the, you know, far left and progressive voters to the polls, who are very motivated, and much more concerned about those traditional swing voters who do include sort of moderate suburban independents and Republicans.
Let's go to the phones here. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Marjorie on the line from Chelmsford. Marjorie, what's on your mind?
Just simply looking at the amount of time and energy that's spent on these campaign trails and conventions, I think at this point people can access information for themselves, and it would be nice to just see each candidate publish a list of who they would put in their cabinet, what their goals are, what their platform is, and let people decide simply on that and not how well they speak or whose hat they're wearing.
Thanks for that, Marjorie. So, Michael, that would really undo retail politics. What do you think of Marjorie's thought there?
You know, I'm always a fan of, you know, we get very traditional around how we do things. And I think what is called for in this time across the country, especially as we engage younger voters, is how do we do old things differently? So, you know, I would not dismiss what she said. I would say less, you know, we should generate a conversation around how we should approach conventions going forward. I will tell you, I don't believe people have all the information at their fingertips. In fact, people don't always know where to go to get accurate, reliable information. I appreciated hearing from those speakers during the convention. We had not heard much from Obama before. That was the medium through which we were able to hear him. So, you know, maybe it's a hybrid. Maybe we do some things differently. So I appreciate her thinking differently.
And I assume, Michael, you mean we hadn't heard much about this race from President Obama before.
That it was exactly. Kind of, he hadn't really been as engaged.
Yeah. And Jane, Marjorie also talked about the platform. And I've been interested to think about how New England has affected that platform. Here's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who gave a convention speech, and she used her reputation as the plan's candidate to endorse Biden's policies. Here she is.
I love a good plan. And Joe Biden has some really good plans. Plans to bring back union jobs in manufacturing and create new union jobs in clean energy. Plans to increase Social Security benefits, cancel billions in student loan debt. These plans reflect a central truth. Our economic system has been rigged to give bailouts to billionaires and kick dirt in the face of everyone else.
So we know she's been advising Joe Biden. We know there were a bunch of Sanders delegates who were pushing really hard or pushing back on the fact that Medicare for All, writ Medicare for All, did not make it into that platform. Did New England have a big impact on the Democratic Party this year?
So I think there definitely has been a lot of the progressives in the New England progressives who have had an impact. I would just say that it is to be determined whether or not Biden sticks with some of the leftward turn that he certainly made based on the strong challenge from both Senator Warren and Bernie Sanders to strong progressives far to the left with their voting record of where the Vice President Biden was during his long tenure in public service. I think with his selection of a running mate and some of the tenor of the convention, you know, there's a little bit of the moving back to the center that you generally see. But he was a far ways left based on some of those New England progressives pushing him there during the primary election. So, you know, I think from that angle, yes, they had an impact.
So one of the things that you just talked about was the New England progressives, and we do know that there's been some push and pull over the presence of the more progressive wing of the party. Elizabeth Warren did feature large there, but Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez didn't necessarily. I think we have a caller who wants to talk about that. So let's go to the phones. We've got Oliver in Watertown.
Hi, I just wanted to point out a couple of things. So the first thing is, I think John Kasich was actually notably standing at a fork in the road, not a crossroads, in his speech. So I think that's kind of symbolic, I think, in the sense that it indicates how different it is, the fact that he was given relatively long speaking time versus progressives, as the previous caller mentioned, like AOC and other progressives, you know, Ed Markey, who is facing a challenge from the right in Massachusetts, and other this inside battle going on in the Democratic Party. And I think it speaks to that, that he was given this kind of platform and others were not.
Oliver, thanks for that. And Michael Curry, let me turn to you on that. There does seem to be a push me, pull you struggle about who owns this party now, the young, upcoming, significantly more progressive leaders, even like our own Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, or more middle of the road representatives of the party, including, many would say, the new vice presidential pick, Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I don't quite frankly think that that we've gained that much traction, that folks like the Ayanna Pressleys and the AOCs have gained that much traction yet. And I think there's a hope among younger voters that there is a groundswell and more momentum to change the face and the movement of the party. I don't think we're anywhere close to that right now. And I think, quite frankly, to the caller's point, I think that that whole DNC convention was really aimed at the voters that they think they need to pull. I often say Democrats are fail at playing chess, that we tend to play checkers too much when Republicans play chess. That was a chess game. That was really about winning, as the governor said, Governor Swift said, winning over the middle of the road folks, those independents, those moderate Republicans, and trying to win them over, because they're not happy with this president either. And in order to tone that down, you didn't talk about defunding police. It wasn't a lot about Medicare. Not surprising, right? Because they're trying to play chess at the convention. But I honestly think it disturbs me that racial justice, environmental and climate justice, reducing student debt is considered far left when it should just be what's right.
There's so much here that I also want to cover, and we're going to go to a break soon. So there are two things that I really want to make sure we at least touch on. I'm going to give you two pieces of sound here. First is Senator Harris and her speech, where she spoke about the racial disparity and how people are affected by the coronavirus.
Black, Latino, and Indigenous people are suffering and dying disproportionately. And this is not a coincidence. It is the effect of structural racism, of inequities in education and technology, healthcare and housing, job security and transportation.
And then here is a clip from Vice President Joe Biden's speech last night that sort of captures the feel of all he said in those 25 minutes.
Let us begin, you and I together, one nation, under God, united in our love for America, united in our love for each other. For love is more powerful than hate. Hope is more powerful than fear. And light is more powerful than dark. This is our moment. This is our mission.
So, Jane, Michael just spoke strongly about the frustration of more progressive issues like environmental justice, for example, or structural racism being considered far left in the party. And I know you're a Republican, but it's why I want to turn to you here. There did seem to be a particular authority to the voice of Senator Harris pulling those messages out in her acceptance speech. And it was striking that the vice president has gone with a message of love and light. Is there something different that the Democratic Party is offering to the wide swath of America than we might have seen 4 years ago?
So I do think that they are attempting to appeal much more broadly. You know, Joe Biden appeals in blue collar America in the very places that Hillary Clinton did not. And to a certain degree, this is about narrative too. You are who you are. And both the vice presidential and the presidential candidate, I think, did a good job in the limited time they had about appealing to their authentic self and to those issues where they have credibility and a strong message to broaden their base.
And Michael, before we go to break, sort of last word from you, what does the party need to do next? What do you want to see and hear in these remaining, you know, fewer than 80 days?
Yeah, I think most importantly is we got to ignite the base. We know that too many young people, too many Black and Brown folks did not show up in the last presidential election because they were not happy with, quite frankly, the party. And maybe there was some concerns even around politics in general. I think they got caught up in sort of the Clinton crime bill, that history, and they didn't show up. It is very important. And I think the convention made this point. And the First Lady Obama made this point. We cannot afford not to show up this time, right? The elections have consequences. So we are making that campaign over the next 70 so days that every person who cares about a Supreme Court nominee, federal judgeships, a consent decrees in the Department of Justice, voter protection, police violence, all those issues that people across this country are marching in the streets about. If you care about those issues, no matter what you feel intuitively about Joe Biden or Kamala Harris and her prosecutorial background, you got to show up.
And We've covered the Democratic National Convention all week. The Republican National Convention starts next week. 1 million people, roughly, in the Commonwealth voted for Donald Trump in 2016. And we will bring the same kind of analysis, the same kind of voices for the RNC next week as we did this week. So, listeners, let's talk local politics now. What races are you watching? What do you make of the heat in the Senate race or the strange unfolding scandal in the race between Congressman Richard Neal and Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse? Are you trying to choose between one of the nine Democratic candidates in the fourth, or maybe weighing whether to return Seth Moulton to Congress in the sixth? Call with your thoughts at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Michael and Jane, I think we have to start with the Kennedy-Markey race, where Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi startled, I think, the political world by endorsing Kennedy yesterday. Here is Nancy Pelosi.
Never before have the times demanded we elect courageous leaders as today. And that is why I'm proud to endorse Joe Kennedy for Senate. In 2018, when we took back the House, Joe campaigned across America to make that victory possible. He knows that to achieve progressive change, you must be on the front lines leading movements of people.
Michael, were you surprised?
Yeah, I absolutely was surprised. I know that there is a rule within the Democratic Party that they've been utilizing. And this goes back many years. But I think for me, when the party came out and supported Capuano over Ayanna Pressley here in Massachusetts, many of us were upset about it. And I felt like, particularly when I thought about the Congressional Black Caucus supported, many of them supported Capuano over Ayanna Pressley. It felt like they didn't know what the times was calling for. So I think there tends to be this old politic within the Democratic Party that has said, we'll support the incumbent. This was a flip for Nancy Pelosi, right? We expected her to support, and if either stay out of it or support the incumbent, and she supported Kennedy in his case. And I think you'll see across the country, some people have weighed in. Even I think our DA in Suffolk County's weighed in. Many elected officials have weighed in, very upset that the party rule of really trying to preserve incumbents was that table was turned over in this case.
Yeah, actually, so I have the tweet. Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins tweeted, quote, "So at Speaker Pelosi can insert herself in our U.S. Senate race, but at Ayanna Pressley was not a speaker at the convention. Nancy, the future of the Democratic Party is not a privileged legacy candidate. It is at Rep. Pressley, at Rep. AOC, at Ilhan, and at Rep. Rashida. I'm sticking with Ed," unquote. Now, it's worth noting that she has endorsed Markey and that according to the Boston Globe, Nancy Pelosi has in fact helped Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib fight off primary challengers. But to Michael's point, Jane, is this another sign of the struggle for the soul of the party, the future of the party, or do we always see these kinds of backs and forths as parties change? I really don't know.
I think this one is really hard to figure out. And there's always, you know, a backroom story that you don't really understand. I think it was definitely a coup, frankly, for Joe Kennedy. I think the race was starting to, a couple of weeks ago, slip away from him a little bit. And he seems to have regained footing and momentum. And so I think that, you know, this one's going to go down to the wire.
Michael, will it affect the race?
Yeah, I think it could affect the race. I think there is very loyal and super fans of Speaker Pelosi here in New England and in Massachusetts particularly that will maybe consider this marching orders for the party. So I think there are people who may be in lockstep and may move their vote or just decide at this point to go with Kennedy. I don't know. I say this is a conflict for me because I like both of them. I think both of them have been champions on the issues that we care about. They have some racial stuff to unpack and address, and we've seen that play out in this race, but they're both good guys and both get high marks from civil rights groups for their work.
So I also want to take a minute to talk about this strange and unfolding controversy over accusations against Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse, who's challenging the chair of the House Ways and Means, Congressman Richard Neal in the first. That's your neck of the woods, Jane Swift. I need to set this up because it's complicated. College Democrats accused the mayor of having sexual relationships with adult-age college students in a way that abused power while teaching at UMass Amherst. Then there were accusations that a young person who wanted to work for Congressman Neal was behind the original accusations, and revelations that the state party had foreknowledge and even provided legal counsel to the group. That's according to reporting in The Intercept. Morse, who's 31 and openly gay, denies that he behaved inappropriately and feels the attacks play on old tropes about gay men and young people. Now UMass Amherst and the state party are both launching investigations. Richard Neal has avoided the topic. Once again, Jane, is this politics as usual, or is there something uglier going on here?
Well, I'll tell you this. Usually in Western Mass, in the first congressional district, which is what this is since the merger of the two districts, this is my district, politics are a little tamer than they are. We don't usually get coverage by the Boston news media. There's not a dominant TV market. So this is a little unusual for the first congressional district. I think this has actually become national news. So I would say that this is not politics as usual for this mostly rural and sort of gateway cities, blue collar industrial district. And I'm not sure, to tell you the truth, how it will play out. There are some very progressive enclaves with college towns. And I think this story has cut to ultimately the benefit of the challenger. But I do think it will cause pause in some of the more traditionally conservative parts of the district. So I think it's just a very unfortunate chapter. I would like to think there are still places in our Commonwealth and in our country where we can debate on the issues.
So Michael, State Senator Julian Sear this week told WBUR that this will have a chilling effect on LGBTQ political hopefuls and that it's harmful to the community. Here he is.
I can tell you it has a chilling effect because I know people who have thought twice about running for public office because they're LGBTQ and they are concerned about how their personal lives will be distorted and used against them. Politics is definitely a blood sport. You know, I think that's just something that I've sort of accepted.
And State Senator Sear himself is gay. Does one have to accept this, Michael? And is there a double standard being applied here?
Yeah, you know, I'm good friends with Senator Sear, and I take him, as the authority on the subject, as he would if we were talking about race issues, and he would defer to me. I have huge deference here that if you're LGBTQ and you want to run for office, these kind of accusations and what could potentially be a use of tropes will deter you from running. So we have to take that seriously and figure out if this case is an example of that or not. And I think if there is anything to be investigated, someone should lean and investigate. If not, then I hope that it remains on the substance of the issues. And as he said, I was thinking the same thing, politics is a blood sport. It's gotten somewhat worse than a blood sport these days. So this race has become very difficult for all involved.
So in about a minute, I want to go to our hubbubs. We have fun ones this week, and I want to make sure to take time for them. So just very briefly from each of you, Jane, state of politics in the Commonwealth, are we healthy right now?
So I think that some of these primary races, primaries are always a little bit ugly because people agree on the issues. And so unfortunately it devolves to some of these other issues. Hopefully we'll recover.
And Michael, what do you think?
I absolutely agree with the governor on that one. You know, she and I agree a lot. I think she and I are not as much Republican Democrat as we become friends. So I'm going to say she was absolutely right.
Well, and I love that, right? Because that's the proof that when we have conversations across any kind of political divide, what we tend to do is find common ground and common cause. So
absolutely.
Let's keep Let's keep doing that. All right, now, before we run out of time here, I do want to leave this space for our hubbubs. These are these brief local events or stories that caught our attention this week. Michael, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I think the story that caught my attention this week is one that's growing. It hasn't really caught most people's attention, but USA Today, and there have been some local stories around the eventual vaccine, which looks like it'll probably be the first quarter of next year. And the whole line of issues around equity and access to the vaccine. So even at a clinical trial standpoint, is there diversity within the clinical trials, which historically there has not been, and the historical deterred, the reasons that people don't get in clinical trials, like to see syphilis, experimentation, abuse of African-Americans, leading up to the prioritization of essential workers, healthcare workers, and people of color who are disparately impacted by the disease. There are campaigns going on right now to start to figure all that out before we get to a vaccine. And we're in this tense moment about how to distribute.
Jane, how about you? What's your hubbub this week?
So Michael is going to make me look bad because he's being very eloquent and serious as a mother.
Yeah, it's a really important and thoughtful subject. It's true.
Exactly. But as a mother, also importantly, sending two students back to campus, one of whom is not going to go back. I've been following very closely all the news nationally about how that is playing out on college campuses. Vanderbilt's provost sent a very strongly worded letter to their campus. Syracuse, a bunch of freshmen showed up on the quad, did not behave. But the best place to look is, I'm going to try to sound more cool than I am, TikTok, Chin for short, my children have showed me. There is a TikTok video, and Chin for short says, if he hears of parties, he will snitch.
It's so we pulled little, some sound.
Yeah.
Yeah, we heard you were going to do this, Jane, so we pulled some sound. Here's a little bit of it. We did. Here's a little bit of it.
If I receive word of any partying going on the campus that I attend, I'm telling.
If you think about it, online university is just like the premium version of DeVry.
I'm not doing Khan Academy from home. I refuse.
It's just kind of ghetto.
So the whole theme of this are these two students in their dorm saying, you party, I'm telling. And Jane, I agree with you. I have a freshman going off to BU moving in tomorrow. And this was exactly what she needed to hear today. She laughed hard when she saw that TikTok. Well, I just want to express my gratitude to both of you for being with us today. You know, we all benefit from such thoughtfulness and high quality conversation. That's former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, who's now the president and executive director of Learn Launch. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
And Michael, it's more wonderful every time. Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, a member of the National NAACP Board, and deputy CEO and general counsel for the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, as always.